We're going to need to spend some time focusing on gun violence in America. As the news every day reminds us that violence continues to increase, caused by literally anything from bullying to going to the wrong apartment door. This violence is mainly reacted to in ways that are obviously not working. My next guest has created a tool that he hopes will get ahead of an act of gun violence so it won't happen. There's a novel thought. He brings to this work his experience as an educator, as well as someone who has experienced a school shooting and has looked across the table into the eyes of a school shooter, Jerry Sparvey. Thanks for being here today, Jerry.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
And what Jerry has created, we'll get to in a moment, is called Huddle Up, and we have the link to Huddle Up at our website. The spelling a bit different, huddlup.org, to find out more. If you are a part of a school district leadership or administration, I hope you will want to find out more after you hear what Jerry has to say about his experiences and about Huddle Up. Talk about experience first, Jerry, because this is why I think what you're doing, you bring weight to it and authority to it because of what you have had to deal with as a being in the environment of a school shooting. Help us understand, because I saw in interviews where you said the shooter, you never saw it coming. You never anticipated this would be someone who would do an act like this.
Yes. So after I was one of those school principals that I took a lot of responsibility. I took it on myself that if parents were going to send their kid to our school, that it was my responsibility to keep them safe. And so one of the things I took pride in was getting to know every kid by their name and their parents by their name. And so people said, well, you have 1,000 kids plus. And I said, yes, but over the years, it's easy to get that figured out. Once you get to know something about them, you can do that. But anyway, I was also one of those principals that spent time out on the playground every day just making sure there weren't kids that were left out or isolated. And so I was pretty confident that we had a great school and as a place where there wasn't bullying going on. And yet, you know, you often see what you look for, right? Or don't look for it. You don't see it. Anyway, the day that of the shooting, I was like, this didn't happen here. This doesn't happen here in this small town, Minnesota. And yet it really did. And so through that process, I spent time with the McLaughlin family, which was Jason's parents. And Dad was in the sheriff's department, and the family is an amazing family. They're so involved in the community and the works, and you say, well, this just didn't happen. And they'd asked me to spend some time with Jason over in the detention center, which I did. And the first day we were there, and he was sitting across the table from me, and 15 years old, and we're looking at each other. We had a little dance with our eyes going back and forth, and pretty soon he whispers, "Can you touch me?" And I nodded, and I whispered back, "Put your hand on the table." And he reached out to put his hand on the table, and I reached out to put my hand on top of his, and the guard hollered, "If you touch him, you're out of here." And Jason just sobbed, and I sobbed, and we sat there and we cried for quite a time. And I realized it's part of what's happened in America is that we've become untouchable. We don't touch each other. We've separated ourselves out. And through that process and conversations and letter exchanges with Jason, one of the things he asked me, he said, "Mr. Sparvey, if you do nothing else with the rest of your life, will you try to make sure that nobody else does what I've done?" And I made that commitment not only to Jason, but myself, but to the families who lost their kids. And as we talked about it, what happened that day, Jason had no recollection of him taking his dad's gun, going to school, and shooting. He had no idea he had done that until one of the teachers screamed at him, "Jason, drop the gun." And he said that was the first realization that he had a gun in his hand and he was shooting it. And so I thought, oh, that can't be. And yet the more we visited, there was no doubt that is exactly what happened. And so I wanted to understand this. And so I went back to school and I started working with intense kids that had either tried to shoot their parents or tried to kill their parents or killed somebody. And I typically found that was pretty much the way it was with every kid, was they got into a zone and they had no idea they were pulling the trigger and wiping people out. And And so that really became a motivator for me in saying, okay, how does this happen? And Jason was one of those who was isolated, and I didn't know that. And I in the classroom, when I walked through the classroom, he seemed like he was participating. When I was out on the playground, I didn't see him alone. And so I asked him, I said, Jason, but I never saw you standing alone. I said, where were you? And he said, I was up on the playground hiding. I didn't want anybody to know I didn't have any friends because I thought they'd pick on me. And so he said, I'd run around and pretend that I had friends, and nobody realized I had no friends. And so he was invisible. And after that day and that conversation in the jail, I went back to the playground and looked, and I thought, oh, my God, I got a dozen of those kids that are hiding. They're all doing what Jason did. And it was like, how do these kids figure out that if they have no friends, they become people pick on them. And so then they pretend otherwise, and yet they're dying of isolation. And so as I started going around, and I've literally been in over 1,000 classrooms, and there's in every classroom I go in, there's 3 or 4 kids that are invisible. And part of it is due to their social awkwardness. Part of it is due to economic status. Part of it is due to their academic status. Part of it is there's so many different pieces that come into play that we justify separating and pushing kids out and isolating. I said, we've got to be able to fix this because it's everywhere. It's not just in 1 or 2 classrooms. It's like I said, I've been in literally thousands of classrooms from Boston to L.A. to Omaha, Nebraska, across Minnesota and Atlanta, Miami. It's everywhere. And so I said, let's figure out a way. And the best way I could figure out was, one, is to get them to play together in a structured situation. And, you know, teachers need a break, and they send kids out for recess. Kids need a break. But unfortunately, nobody teaches kids how to do recess.
Yeah.
And so that pecking order continues back out in the playground, right?
It does. It does. When it comes to the school shootings that we hear over and over and over again, not every time, but most often, it's because of isolationism and bullying, or the two combined, that become the powder keg that create. I mean, I'm not a shrink, but over the years of doing the show, I've certainly spoken with enough of them, and that's the quality of rage. It's an out-of-body experience, in a manner of speaking, where that's not you in there, and I bet if, I don't know if you explored that with Jason, was he watching himself in a way, doing what he did?
Yeah, it was. He just definitely had a disassociation. He was out of the body. He was not there. And you're right, Chris. It's what I experienced when I was in San Bernardino with the shooter down there. He too had it was not present, and he was isolated. And he was invisible. And the kid up in Santa Barbara that did the shooting, he did. It was the same exact profile as Jason. And everywhere I go, and I've been to a number of the places that had school shootings, and the kids all pretty much have the same profile, and that is they're invisible. And you know, when you're a little kid, before you hit adolescence, somehow you manage to work your way through that. But when you get to be adolescence and you get all those emotions in you, things start shifting in you. And when they stop blaming themselves, then they gotta push the anger out someplace so it goes out at others, right?
Well, then
it's part of the human.
And if you have no value of yourself, you're not going to have value for the life of others. And doing what Jason and all these other shooters do, to them, it's leveling their vision of the playing field. We're talking with Jerry Sparby about school shooters and being proactive to extinguish the fire that's burning in them through what Jerry has created, Huddle Up, HUDDLUP, the website HUDDLUP.org, and it's up on our homepage as we always do. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. So let's move into what you have created and how it's being implemented in schools across the country. What are the functions of Huddle Up?
Okay, so one of the things I realized is that, one, teachers don't have play history. They don't know how to play games with kids, and it's not making them bad. When I work with parents, they don't have a play history, and they don't know what to play with kids. And so when I'm working with families and I say, you know what, your kids need to be played with, and they say, well, we don't know what to play. And so I said, well, what have you been playing? And they say, well, Candyland. And I said, well, how many times do you play Candyland? Well, 3 or 4 times. And okay. But I realized that it's about they needed a resource. And so it's like when I was working with these parents that have kids between 0 and 5, they had no idea what they could do with a 3 or 4-year-old. And I said, okay, if you got a basket of socks, here's some activities you can do. Or if you got a bag of marshmallows, here's some things you could do with that bag of marshmallows. It wasn't about going out and buying more games or whatever. It was about what do you have in the house to play with your kids with. And it's not always about bouncing a basketball. It's about, you know, as a little preschooler, you can't do that. And likewise, in the school classrooms and on playgrounds, it's all those competitive games. And competitive games kind of push people away. And I'm not against competition. But what we created was a digital library. It's not about going online and playing games. It's about getting kids off the screen. It's about giving a resource so that if you got an eight-year-old and you don't want to play with he or she, or if you've got a classroom of third graders and you have no idea what to do, that you can push in here. You can put in 8-year-olds and you want to say you want to teach a character of honesty, let's say, for example. You can select that character trait, and the app will sort it down and give you, you know, 15, 20 games that you can play that will teach or work for 8-year-olds and teach honesty. And it's like I said, it's a resource. It's right at your fingertips. And the one thing we're working on right now is trying to make those games more adaptable, handicapped adaptable. And we were in a hurry to get it out. We reworked the games. We tried to make the games understandable. And the other thing I need to make sure that people understand is that these are games that Jim and Brian and I, we used in our classrooms, we used with our families, we used when we were coaching. And a lot of these games, the majority of the games, are games that we found that other people had created. And of the 1,000 games, we probably created 200, 250 of them ourselves. But so my concern was copyright, and I run it past a lawyer in Washington, D.C., and she said, oh, no. It's a digital library. These games are accessible to everybody. It's not about your claiming that you've made all these games. But anyway, she said, but my God, Jerry, this is what I need for my kids. She said, I have no idea what to do with my own kids. And she said, this is perfect. And so that was the other motivator behind this whole piece. So it's a library. It's a digital library with a resource that gives you an idea of things you can do with kids, whether in the classroom or at home.
We have to bring things to an end here, sadly, but for any school teacher, administrator, official listening right now, how can they bring Huddle into their school system?
Honestly, the best way to get a hold of it is through huddleup.org. And they can get online there and let us know they're interested. We're in the process of reaching out all over, and we're trying to raise money because right now we're in over 100 classrooms, and we were able to raise money so that we didn't have to charge any of the schools anything. But unfortunately, we've got to raise more money now. And so we haven't figured that piece out yet. We're hoping to find resources. But if we know there are people that are classrooms, administrators, teachers that are definitely interested, we will figure out a way to help them create this model within their classroom.
I was going to mention that, too, just to bring things to a close here. If you've been listening to what Jerry has been describing through his experiences and through the action he has taken from those experiences, and even if you don't have a child in a school system, but you think this is the way to go, you can go to huddleup.org and make a donation as well and help this very, very effective tool become more and more useful, more and more accessible to more and more school districts to hopefully extinguish that fire that we always learned about after the fact when a school shooting takes place. HUDDLUP.org. We also have the link at our homepage. Jerry Sfarbi, you are moving things to the proper direction, the proper focus, and hopefully more people will think of things and look at things as you do to prevent as opposed to react. So congratulations on what you're doing with Huddle Up. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Chris, for the opportunity. You have a great day.